Welcome to Recess Duty, a podcast for educators to come together to share struggles, but also celebrate successes by sharing stories and ideas in a safe and supportive environment to collaborate with one another. Here's your host, Levi Allison.
Hey everyone, this is Recess Duty with your host, Levi Allison. And today we're talking with speaker and author of The Joy of Now Knowing, Marcelo Starkoff. Thank you so much for joining us, Marcelo. I'm so excited to have you on here. You were highly recommended. How are you doing today?
Thank you so much, Levi, for inviting me to be on your amazing podcast, which I've been really enjoying listening to.
Thank you.
Podcast. It's a huge honor and a huge privilege to be on here and having the opportunity to share lots of very exciting ideas with you. And also to feel that our connection has come through a very exciting motivational, inspirational, professional learning network.
For sure.
International learning network that we've just been connecting over the last few months. It's just so exciting. And all the people involved and all the opportunities that are arising as a result are just fantastic. So, yeah.
I agree.
The culmination of something very special.
Exactly. I always say, like, the strongest professional development or professional learning is my circle of friends through social media. And I love how learning no longer has to take place in four walls. It is at the fingertips. It's micro learning. And it is an amazing, powerful tool that we have as educators that I don't know what we would do without. So, Marcelo, tell us a little bit about yourself for those of you, our listeners who may not know you.
Thank you so much, Levi. Yes, I'm delighted to meet everyone. And thank you, everyone, for switching on and listening. I hope you find today really exciting. Yeah, I have a slightly unusual entry into the educational system, Levi, because, first of all, I was born in Argentina and came over to England when I was 11. Straight into secondary school without speaking a word of English. So that was a very interesting sort of introduction into the educational system in England. So we've been here ever since. I then went to university at Sussex and I studied environmental science. And very interestingly, I then did a PhD in biochemistry looking at liver cells at the London Hospital. And I followed a career in as a research scientist for the next 5 years or so. We moved to Bristol and I worked on researching red blood cells at the University of Bristol. And after 5 or 6 years as a scientist, you know, doing science research. Our first child was born and I kind of realized that I was looking for a more sort of secure career and something that would not have to rely on short-term grants and the insecurity of research science. So I decided to move to retrain, and I did a PGC in Bristol in primary education. And it's one of the best decisions I've ever made, I think. It was just loved it from day one. I mean, I've always really enjoyed teaching, and I've always really enjoyed being and helping and volunteering primary schools. You know, I've always had that kind of real interest in education. And then I was very, very luckily to land in two absolutely fantastically exciting schools in Bristol. It's my first two schools, my first 3 years at Christchurch and then the following 3 years at Westbury Park in Bristol were so formative. And I met so many people at that, you know, at that time. We worked in collaboration with the University of Bristol on the lifelong learning dispositions. I got very involved with SAPRE and the world of philosophy and inquiry in the classroom. I became very involved in the world of creative thinking and developing thinking skills. So it just all it was at the time where there was a lot of opportunity to, with the schools I was in and the heads' visions with which I was working, there was a lot of opportunity for experimenting, investigating, having a go at different things, seeing what worked. And that's, there was a sense of freedom, a professional sense of freedom that I valued so much at that time. And having come from a career as a scientist, I guess I was bringing into education that sense of inquiry. You know, a research scientist is always looking to find out things that nobody knows and discover things.
Yeah.
I kind of brought that, that way of being into the classroom with the children. And it was just incredibly, incredibly fascinating.
I was going to ask, as somebody who did have a very successful career in science and research and medical, what did you see as some, like, sorry for the pun, but the bleed over into the educational field?
I think primary education was something that always fascinated me. I just, making the decision of going over, you know, retraining and launching a new career, I think had a kind of multifaceted reasons behind it. But overall was the sort of excitement of being with a, particularly in primary, being with a class of amazing 30 individuals every single day for a year, and the potential of what one can achieve or what one can shape in terms of the aspirations and their enjoyment and their enthusiasm for wanting to learn and to discover. You know, that was always fascinating me, is the enthusiasm with which young children launch their time in education. You know, as I say in the book, that the children are, I believe children are born as natural philosophers. You know, they're born wanting to know, wanting to inquire, questioning. So they're born as philosophers, aren't they? And I saw the opportunity, as soon as I got into the classroom, the opportunity of nurturing that natural inquisitiveness that the children come with as part of the everyday life of the classroom. And that's what really, really, really excited me. And then from Bristol, we moved back to Brighton, actually, just by chance, because my wife's job brought us back to Brighton, where I had gone to university at Sussex before. And I took the opportunity to then move on to sort of senior leadership, and I became a deputy head and eventually a head teacher of a couple of schools here in Brighton. And then post-headship, I worked in headship, the whole educational philosophy that I was developing sort of came together from a strategic whole school leadership point of view. And that's during those years is where the phraseology and the idea of writing the book, which is now called The Joy of Not Knowing, came about. And I, you know, post-headship, I had so much material, so many times in which amazing things happened, either with the children or with the families or with the staff team, that I thought it'd be great to structure it all and put it all together in terms of how one can set up a whole school approach to making children and the staff team really enjoy the process of education.
No, and, for sure.
Yeah, and in the last 3 years, and actually from today, last couple of years I've been over to Sussex, but from today, Levi, it's the first, my first day of the permanent position as lecturer at Sussex on the teacher training program. So it really is a very special moment to share with you and to kind of feel that it's
full circle.
Full circle, hasn't it?
Wow. Well, congratulations. That's an amazing achievement. And I can't wait for everyone to rally for you. And your book is, I love the title because we live in a world where we're always seeking answers and we're always trying to learn new things. And I don't think in my own classroom, we really get to just set in that moment of not knowing and really embrace the fact that we live in an age where we have so much information at our fingertips that we can know anything almost instantaneous. I think we miss some of that energy that comes from not knowing and being like, oh, well, how could we know? What could we know? How could we know it and figure it out? And I love that your book came so authentically about student inquisitors and coming through with your faculty and coming through as a way to nurture what children do very naturally with asking questions.
Absolutely, you've summed it up beautifully. It was very, very perceptive. And what really fascinated me during the early years of teaching and then through headship was noticing those moments in which amazing things happened. You know, there was moments, you know, when there are moments in the classroom where you present something in a way that the children just take it way beyond what your expectations. Those are the kind of moments that have always really fascinated me. When there's that intrinsic motivation from a child to take the idea, the learning objective, the discussion that's happening way beyond any expectations. And I think that's the magic to education. And I started to think about those moments, and I started to think about what is it that prompts those that intrinsic motivation in a child. And I started to realize that it always happened when the children were learning without realizing that they were learning.
Yes.
And I think that's a really interesting thing I wanted to kind of share with you today, Liva. The kind of, if we think about the early years foundation stage when children are so immersed and so happy to learn within their the EYFS environment.
Yeah, they're sponges. They absorb everything.
They're sponges. But if you think about it, I think the key to that success is because they are learning through play and learning through discussion, conversation, inquiry, all those sorts of things. But they're not realizing that they're learning. I think that's the key. And as soon as the situation makes children feel conscious that they are learning, then it starts to become a little less easy to.
Yep.
So the key approach to the whole of the joy of not knowing approach is what I call intellectual playfulness, which is a lovely, lovely phrase first introduced to me by Deborah Eyre, who I did a lot of work with early on in my career. And the sense that is after reception and throughout their time in school and throughout their lives, if there's a way of presenting the learning in a way in which inspires the children to still play, but to play intellectually, then that's where the magic happens. And in those moments, I think children are really at their best because they don't realize that they're actually learning. So it's that.
Marcel, I completely agree with you. As someone who teaches music and I have to deal with so many students being like, oh, I can't sing. Oh, I can't play. I don't do rhythm. And there's so much negative connotation because music is a very personal thing. There's so much on YouTube and social media is you're either good or you're not at music. But what I try to do is bring in that we can all be musicians. We can all learn music. We can all be a little bit more artistic. But the way I get them to do it is through playing games, playing playground games where it's circle games and it's little dances. And And finally, when I asked them, so what did we learn today? And they're like, we didn't learn. We played a game. And I'm like, okay.
Exactly.
What about the game, though? Talk about the game. And they have to break it down. I'm like, so what did we do today? And they're like,
exactly.
I guess we kind of learned. And it's and now they come to class being like, Mr. Levi, are we playing games or are we learning? And I'm like, why can't they be the same thing?
Exactly. And so interesting to hear that, Levi, because the key that opened the door to all of this and the shaping of what's now become the Joy of Not Knowing philosophy and approach was the idea of welcoming the children in the morning. So I was always very interested in ensuring that the children would look forward to coming in. That was a really...
For sure.
So what I started to do is to start to welcome them with a task, an open-ended task on the board, a challenge. And it became so amazing having a challenge in which that was very, every day was completely different. But the idea was that every child could succeed with it. They would really look forward to that. They now call thinking skill starters. And in fact, it became a book, my first book in 2005 called Start Thinking. It's just, we put a collection of those starters together for teachers to use. And it just really, really transformed the way that children were viewing the whole aspect of school, were viewing how to come in, the way that they're coming into school, the enthusiasm with which they're engaging in those open-ended starters, where there was no right or wrong answer, they were completely open-ended. But most importantly was in their creativity, in their ability to then share some amazing ideas. And then I started to see that with those starters, we would then shape what happened during the day. So the enthusiasm with which the children were contributing and engaging those starters would give, the energy and drive for the rest of the day. So that was great.
I love that. I love that, Marcelo, because so many times I see some beautiful thinking and some really amazing actions go into these starters, and then my heart breaks when it's the typical, all right, now it's math, everybody put all those things away.
Exactly.
And so the fact that those things, those starters, those energizers, those really morning things can be woven into the day, and absolutely, just makes a very beautiful tapestry of learning doesn't just take place in 45 minute chunks.
Absolutely. They were the key. Yes. And then there's a lovely section in the book where there's lots of quotes from children in terms of, how much they enjoy them, how much it meant to them, how it would wake them up to, for the rest of the day and all sorts of things. But then very interestingly, Levi extended that idea to the playground. And I know we'd in a recess podcast, so I developed the idea of thinking in playgrounds. So I created a blackboard in the playground with where I would place, and lots of schools are doing this now, where they just place an open-ended question, a philosophical question, any or challenge, anything at all on the blackboard, and just leave chalk out there. And as the families start to arrive, they start to engage with it. And it was just the most incredible transformational thing that I think I've ever done in terms of promoting that sense of community within the school, that sense of the families spending a few minutes before school starts contributing to it, chatting with each other, that those moments became really, really, really precious. And I've always found that nurturing that triangular relationship between the child, the school and the family is the key to developing that positive kind of frame of mind of schooling and of the enthusiasm for wanting to come in. So yeah,
I couldn't agree more. My whole attitude towards the community is we need to all be together for this kid to be successful. We're not all going to have the answers. If you have something, I have something, grandma has something, the next door neighbor has something, the shopkeeper down the street has something, then this kid is going to be much more successful in being an international minded human being.
Exactly. I have, you know, it's amazing what you're saying, but I still remember one of the questions one day was, what is your favorite toy? So everyone was coming in and just drawing, contributing. And there was this one grandma with her grandchild in year one with tears in her eyes. And I just went up to her and said, yeah. And she said, yes, I'm drawing a little, my favorite doll that I still have that I was given when I was born. This is grandma. Wow. And it was just such, you know, can you imagine just linking school with such an emotional aspect of a family's life? Mm-hmm. It's tremendous. And then we also had things like, so I was very interested in making school feel part of the local community, national community, but also the global community. So every child felt a sense of belonging to all those communities and families. And this was at Hartford Innocence, and I was head there. It was a time when the Chilean miners got trapped in the mine, mm-hmm. in the coal mine. I don't know if you remember, but there was a day when all over the world, we could see how they were all being rescued one by one. And on that day, we on the board, on the blackboard, we had messages for the miners, for the Chilean miners. And every family wrote something really, really wonderful. And wrote it not just in English, but also in their language, because one of the main things that underpins the joy of not knowing approach is the idea that school should be multilingual and multicultural, and give those multilingual and multicultural opportunities to all the families. So they were writing on the board in all sorts of languages. We collected all that and sent it to the miners. It was so, so special. The other thing that then kind of gelled everything together, Levi, was the sense. So once this sense of intrinsic motivation was developing, I also realized that the other key was when these magical moments are happening, was when children were free from worry.
Yeah.
So the starters were freeing them from worrying, because they were just, we always said that those, the thinking books were the only books were never marked. So they never worried. There was no kind of sense of right or wrong. But I started to think that if one could take away that anxiety, that sense of worry and kind of feeling uneasy when we're about to learn, one can achieve so, so much, which is how the phraseology of the joy of not knowing came about. Because I realized that if we get the children to realize that in order to learn something new, we have to not know it first, then it becomes really, really a transformational moment for them. Because what I try to develop and to explain through the book is that the usual, you know, emotionally, we tend to feel really good when we know the answer. So if I asked you a question now and you knew the answer, you would feel good, wouldn't you? And children love putting their hand up and knowing the answer. So emotionally, as human beings, we kind of program to feel good when we know. That's our sense of safe space. Mm-hmm. And sense of emotional well-being comes from when we know things, when we feel we can succeed, all those sorts. But I realized that by knowing the answer, we're not learning anything new. We already know it.
True.
So the whole of the joy of not knowing approach suddenly developed by discussing with the children that in order to learn something new, we have to not know it first. And it just became really, really fascinating to discuss all that, just that very simple concept with the teachers, with the children, and develop a way in which that could really make sense. And that's how the kind of whole idea that the joy of not knowing came about. Because if we are placing the children in a situation where they are aware that they don't know, What we then need to do within the school is to create the conditions in which they will feel comfortable with not knowing, because they realize that that is the place where we must all be in order to learn. So it's what we, it's what I call making children feel comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Oh, agreed. And Marcel, I know our listeners are going to be nodding their heads in agreement with having students interact with something that they don't know and being told, this is too hard. I don't know. I don't get it. I always say, as a music teacher, that's the point. Exactly. Why would I give you music, or why would I give you something that you already know?
Exactly.
And I said, how you're feeling is expected. It's wanted, and it's okay. We all are feeling that. And it's okay to feel uncomfortable, because we're all going to support each other to get to that point where we do know. And it's okay. And the moment, and I have one little boy in my head, because he was so nervous. He was so nervous that he didn't understand the song. And I said, little boy's name. I said, it's okay. We don't need to know it. It's the first day you've ever seen this piece of music. And he was like, so I don't have to know it immediately? And I said, no. You don't have to know it in the next month. Like, it's going to be, it's going to be a journey, and it's okay. And I wish I could have taken a photo of his face when he realized
exactly
that it was safe to not know, because he had been under the impression that he needed to know everything immediately, right when it was presented to him.
Absolutely. You're so right, Levi. That's a lovely, lovely story. And in fact, with the joy of not knowing, when their children get first introduced to it, we say to them that it's brilliant that they don't know. It's absolutely brilliant to not know. And it just that little phrase completely changes their lives. Mm-hmm. To give them the permission to be confused, to not know, and to regard that position as being the key to them being able to learn is magical, because if they suddenly start to realize that it's great to not know, because that's the opportunity to then know something new. It's incredibly exciting. And the other thing that becomes very, very exciting when children start to think about the joy of not knowing is that they then start to think about, whenever there's some learning presented to them, they start to think about what they know that they know and what they know that they don't know. And it's really interesting, because that sets the scene before any learning happens. Just a child starts to, you know, that kind of metacognitive approach of mm-hmm. thinking, I know that I know this, so I can build on my knowledge, but I also know that I don't know this. So knowing what you don't know is very, very exciting, because then the intrinsic motivation makes them want to know what they know they don't know.
Yeah,
because if we don't know something, we can either want to know it or not interested.
Yeah.
So hope in school, when we create the conditions in which children want to know what they know they don't know, is absolutely fascinating. And the way that they want to know what they know they don't know is because they know that the school provides them, like you say, with everything they need to be able to succeed socially, emotionally, cognitive, culturally, linguistically. So then they
feel safe to explore, and
they feel very safe
and be okay with not knowing exactly the answer, that they can go be like, you know what, I don't know this answer, but I have a question. Who can I talk to help me figure
exactly.
it out?
Exactly, Levi. So then the phraseology that the children love is that then they know when all that's all together within the school, they know how to know what they want to know that they know they don't know. So that's the key. If they know how to know, they feel supported and able to thrive. They will. That's the key to them wanting to know what they know they don't know, and that's the key. And the other very key aspect to the whole junk approach is that once they get to know the answer, Then in the junk approach, there's a step after that. So children become very, very excited by not just finding the answer or getting some new knowledge, but also moving from that knowledge to wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really fascinating aspect, because a lot of education can seem to stop at the tick when the child gets the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think is really fascinating, what then brings us back to the very beginning, you know, when children go way beyond what we're expecting, is when they take that new knowledge and set themselves other challenges or keep it going or use that knowledge in a different context or experiment with new questions. So that new knowledge is always the beginning of a whole new set of inquiry and questions, which is really, really fascinating. And it's also an opportunity they see through the junk approach that having new knowledge is a way of seeing how well they understand the context of that new knowledge. So
mm-hmm.
they very often get sort of asked to try and go back to the learning position and try and get to the same answer using a different strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when you so there's just, yeah, this it's just and so it's, full of exciting ideas when we share the process of learning with the children in this way, it's really, really fascinating.
Absolutely. And it's always beautiful to me when a student really gets that light bulb moment, and instead of being, I'm done, they go in, what's next? What other questions do I have? Because they always come out with more questions than they came in with.
Exactly. And how does this apply to my life? You know, what's the relevance of it? It's what we call the sort of the meaning making aspect and making connections with their sense of the world. Yeah. So it's really amazing. But in order to do all this, Levi, I suddenly realized that in wanting the children to be in this way, at school, we're very good at teaching them knowledge and teaching them information and sharing. But I realized that there isn't a lot of kind of specific, explicit focus on teaching them how to be successful learners. So you'll see in the book that the sort of the main structure of the book is devoted to encouraging schools to launch the academic year with a learning to learn week. And as we speak now, today's the first day of term here in England. Many schools are launching with a joint learning to learn week, where the first week of the academic year and the first week with a class is dedicated to creating those conditions in which children will feel that they're working in a classroom that functions as a community of inquiry, where they feel safe and is values led and children's rights led and lifelong learning dispositions led. And then where they will be able to take risks with their thinking and succeed in every way. So there's a whole week of activities related to then developing their own models of learning, developing ideas for creative thinking, for visible thinking, for philosophical inquiry, and for acquiring the dispositions of lifelong learners. So in that week, they get given all the skills, dispositions, attitudes, and values that will enable them to succeed during the year. And it's a really interesting concept, isn't it? To do it all, to give them everything they need.
Mm-hmm.
So then they see the key to that week is that then they feel able to succeed. So it's all about their self-esteem, all about they feel equipped and they feel they will be able to succeed. Whether they can or not later on doesn't matter, but it's the feeling that they can succeed that's really important. So yeah, that's
and that power and that feeling of empowerment is only a snowball that's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. The more times they try, the more times they be successful.
Exactly.
Marcelo, I can talk to you all.
It brings me back, Lou, sorry, one more little thing. It brings me back to something that's been very special to me all along, which is the quote by Einstein's quote, where he always said that he never taught his students. He just created the conditions in which they could learn. And that's such a, if you think about that, it's such a wonderful statement, isn't it, to think that as teachers, we're not just there to teach, to fill the empty vessels with information, but we created the conditions in which they can learn. And that's always been a very, kind of very central to all I've done and all I'm doing. But I've added a little bit to Einstein's quote, which is that it's not just enough to create the conditions in which they will want, that they'll be able to learn, but we also need to create the conditions in which they will want to learn. Yeah. And I'll just finish with one quote from a child, if I may, Levi, just
that
describes the whole thing so beautifully. At the end of the year, you know, children write in their report a kind of statement about their year. And Monica, a child in year five, once wrote, she said, "Year five was a special year for me, and I know for the others too. Before I came to year five, I thought when you learn, it's just about intelligence. But now I know it's about a love for learning, creativity, happiness, and effort." It's quite emotional. So you can't, as a teacher, you cannot ask.
That's exactly what we want.
What we're creating with our students, with our children. Yeah.
I mean, in that kind of mind shift of what learning in school is what I truly think we all want. We all want students to walk away empowered to learn, not because they have to or because it's what we do, but because it's just an exciting part of what we do as a species is we learn and we get better and we grow. And she's taken that as such a beautiful moment.
Exactly. And I just think it's so special to equate, you know, we started with the whole concept that learning is difficult, places in a position of not knowing, of being uncomfortable. And then for a child to think that to equate that with happiness is tremendously powerful. And the last page of the book is a similar example that a child, a seven-year-old child in Spain created, because the whole concept is based on the idea of going into a pit, the learning pit, and coming out again. And he calls it the pit of happiness. You know, it's amazing. And you see in the book, he's drawn himself with a friend smiling, saying, "I don't know," inside the pit, which is incredible.
What a way to change how we look at that graphic that we've all seen.
You know, the other person you must have on your show is the person that first introduced me to the learning pit is James Nottingham. It's absolutely wonderful.
Ah, thank you.
Next guest, probably. Yeah.
We'll see what we can do. We always try to get more and more people involved. So, Marcelo, tell people who would like to continue following you, learn more from you, where can they find you?
I'll be delighted to connect with anybody at all at any time. Share the have you got a means of sharing my email?
Yes. So all of the links and everything will be in the show notes down below.
Yeah, so email's great. I'm on Twitter quite a lot, on M. Starikov on Twitter, and that's the kind of the main way of interacting globally with a group of educators. Yes, and absolutely would be delighted to hear, to share, to learn from your listeners and to carry on forming part of this wonderful community. And if there's anything I can do or lead or work with anyone in any school or with it through Zoom on in schools, I'd be absolutely delighted to.
That's awesome. Thank you, Marcelo, for coming. Marcelo, we end all episodes here on the Recess Studio with our guests talking about recess when they were growing up. So what do you remember about recess growing up as a child?
Yeah, very interesting. In primary school in Argentina, my recess was always playing football. It was, but we weren't allowed to play with balls. So we had to, we used to use wrap, you know, sweet wrappers all put up together into a little ball. We had to create so many different ways of trying to get a ball because we weren't allowed to have a ball. So that was my, that's my main memory of recess.
That was the first inquiry question, how to get a ball.
Exactly. So we went through many different alternatives, some of which lasted more than others. That was, I guess, my launch into a career in research. And then coming to secondary school, again, my memories is not understanding anything, not knowing anyone, not doing anything, but I have my one memory from when I first started was that I was out in recess and the child says, if you know, I've got this lovely stopwatch, and you can have it if you run all the way around the playground. So I thought, great. So I ran all the way around the playground, and when I came back, he said, April's Fool.
Oh no.
And I had no idea, no concept. I'd never heard of the phrase. I didn't know what April Fool's was. I didn't know it. That's my memory of recess.
Oh. Well, what a way to remember recess growing up. Thank you, Marcelo, for coming to this week's episode of Recess Duty. Be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss our next episode. I'm Levi Allison, and I hope you have a great day of learning, everyone. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Recess Duty. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. In the meantime, please share this podcast with other educators so they can join the fun. And that is the end of our Recess Duty.